It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Coming up later, we'll hear from a guest who says countries like the United States need to rethink the way they approach international disaster relief. First, according to a USA Today report out yesterday, Army morale is at a low despite a six-year resilience program that cost almost $300 million. Data from resilience tests, which all soldiers were required to complete each year, indicate that over half of soldiers indicate that they're unhappy in their job and worried about their future in the military. With us now is Greg Zaroya, a USA Today reporter who covers the impact of war on soldiers and their families. He wrote an article on this in yesterday's issue of the paper. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
So I touched on a couple of the points there. What were some of the main conclusions of these findings on Army morale?
Well, I think they were really surprised to find that when it came to issues like trusting leadership or trusting peers, a large portion, I think in this case about 40%, scored very poorly on that areas. And then when it came to optimism, some of the figures were even more dramatic. Over half showed pessimism, actually, in the outlook for their futures.
What did the Army say to your request for information on this report and to your reporting?
It was dicey. I mean, when I first obtained the documents that were provided to me, I approached the Army about it, and they I think this particular office was not very happy about it. They have a program where they try to instill resiliency in the troops, and these numbers show that things weren't going as well as they'd hoped. Their first move was to kind of deny that they thought the numbers even existed. When I provided supporting documents, they suggested that the formulas behind the numbers were out of date.
Now, this is a relatively new program in the history of the Army. Is there a sense that Army morale is particularly low now compared to past decades?
Well, actually, when I provided some of this data to authorities who follow the Army and follow the military, they didn't really find it very surprising. I think given the fact that we're coming off of 14 years of war, in which the Army was a key service involved in the combat, along with the fact that the Army's downsizing, and there's some moves underway in Congress to perhaps curtail some of the ways in which they're supported through health care or through retirement. Many of the soldiers are worried about the future, about their jobs, and they weren't surprised at all by these numbers.
Talking to Greg Zaroya from USA Today, looking at some new information showing, upsettingly, from the Army perspective, low morale among soldiers. Now, walk us through, Greg, this resilience program. Why was it started? What was it supposed to do?
Well, this came up in 2009 when the Army was in the middle of two wars, and we're seeing a high rise and increase in suicides and PTSD. They were looking for ways, grasping for ways to try to deal with these problems. At the University of Pennsylvania, there's a psychologist named Marty Seligman who had an idea about instilling positive psychology into subjects by teaching them coping mechanisms and so on. And they'd seen some limited success with high school children for depression. The Army, eager for something to try to make soldiers tougher to withstand the stresses of combat and military life, embraced this completely and launched a fairly expensive program designed to teach soldiers this positive psychology, and been doing it since 2006.
And the results, as you say, not looking good in terms of a lot of morale-type things. Also, something that's surprising to me, some basics of life, nutrition, health, lack of sleep. What kind of results do they get in those parts of the study?
Right. Well, they expanded this this test that soldiers take every year that kind of measures their resiliency to also kind of keep them informed about how they're eating, whether they're eating properly, whether they're getting enough sleep, and so on. And the numbers showed that, in terms of those who were doing poorly, something like 56% of the Army didn't have proper nutrition, and nearly 60% were not getting enough sleep, which, of course, is a growing problem nationwide.
Now, you've done other reporting looking at comparisons between soldiers who have been in active duty in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and those who've been in the service but not in a war zone. Is there indications that things are worse for those people, as we might expect, who are returned from an active war zone?
Well, I think certainly the ones that are exposed to traumatic events where they've been involved in violent activity, where they've seen their comrades killed or wounded, or they've had their lives threatened, certainly are at higher risk for things like post-traumatic stress disorder. But the Army's been at as well as some of the other services, have been kind of at what they call a high tempo for across the service for a number of years now, and not just for those who go into combat, but there can be stress-related issues for deployments away from families, for the constant state of change that the military has been involved in. It's just been a tough time for the volunteer force.
Now, you mentioned earlier the issue of suicide in the military. That's part of what this resilience training was aimed at tackling. Outside of this resilience training, what has the military been doing to try to get at this issue and prevent suicides, either of active duty troops or after they've left active service?
Well, this has been an area that has really caused a tremendous amount of consternation, both within the active duty forces and, quite frankly, for the Department of Veterans Affairs for veterans, where you also see high rates of suicide, particularly among those leaving the service. And so there's been a lot of things done. They've tried to reduce the stigma associated with behavioral health care. They've tried to bring the services of counselors, psychologists, further down the chain and to make them available to soldiers more readily. They've tried to educate them about ways to look out for each other. What are the warning signs for people who might need counseling or who even may be thinking about suicide. So they've worked very hard to try to address these problems and kind of break down what's been a kind of a tradition of hesitancy by soldiers to reach out and seek help.
Well, one of the first stops for help, as I understand in the military, might be a chaplain. And you've reported on this. Are chaplains prepared? Are they feeling prepared to deal with these psychological issues and possible risk of suicide?
Well, there was a RAND Corporation study in which they surveyed several thousand chaplains and chaplain assistants to try to get a sense of whether they feel they're equipped to help soldiers. Often chaplains are the first line of defense when it comes to emotional issues, and many soldiers rely on them because there's a confidentiality aspect to speaking to a chaplain. They know that what they say to these people stays just between them. The chaplains work very hard, and many of them are exposed to situations where soldiers say they are exposed to situations where soldiers have discussed suicide. And some of them are concerned that they may not have all the necessary training to deal with those kinds of circumstances. And the conclusion in the RAND study was that it might be a good idea to provide more suicide prevention training to Army chaplains and chaplain assistants.
Now, these issues we're talking about, mental health issues, suicide issues in the military, it flares up, it seems like. Politicians, Congress will make a big deal about this. There's been criticism of the VA. Do you get a sense from within the armed forces that they are really responding with alarm and trying to tackle these things? Or are these resilience programs, things like this, just sort of a window dressing to publicly address these concerns?
Well, I think they believed, for example, the resiliency program was something that could work. Going so far as to say they think it's window dressing, I'm not so sure. But I do think that there are concerted efforts, particularly when it comes to making behavioral health resources available, where there is a sincere effort to try and hire more counselors, make them available to the service members and so on. I mean, this is a problem that has gotten incredible attention, and which the military is very sensitive about. As a result, the numbers of suicides rose sharply beginning in about 2004 to record levels in 2009, and quite frankly, since then, they've remained at high levels each successive year.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me.
That's Greg Zaroya. He's a reporter with USA Today. His piece on low Army morale appeared in yesterday's edition of the paper. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As we've seen many times throughout the world in recent years, natural disasters have the power to completely devastate a region, leading to tremendous loss of life, huge economic losses as well, especially in poorer countries. When that happens, developed countries like the U.S. often step in and offer aid. But according to our next guest, disaster aid from wealthier countries doesn't always line up with the affected country's actual needs. The worst disasters don't always get the most aid, and maybe a new approach, he says, is needed. Joining us now is Tim Kovach. He's an analyst and blogger who researches and writes about climate change, disaster risk reduction, and environmental peace building. He recently wrote a piece on disaster relief for Vox. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, first of all, give us a sense of the scope when we look at the human and the economic impact of these disasters. What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Yeah, people tend to focus a lot on conflict and violence, but in reality, the effects of disasters globally are truly astounding. From 1980 to 2000, disasters killed approximately 1.5 million people. And directly affected by that, we mean killed, injured, displaced, more than 2.3 billion worldwide. And recently, the UN's agency who works on disasters noted that there have been more than 48 million life years lost in the past 20 years or so. And by that, they mean dying prematurely based on the expected life expectancy for a person in a given country. And the economic costs from these disasters are truly astonishing. Currently, they cost roughly $250 to $300 billion per year, and that number is expected to grow to over $315 billion within the next few years. And if you look at especially the total dollar values are going to be greater in countries like the U.S. and Japan and the U.K. because we have a much larger economy. But if you look at the per GDP effects of disasters in poorer countries, they can be truly amazing. Large disasters in least developed countries can reduce GDP from anywhere to 5 to 15% in any given year.
Now, you write that there's often a mismatch. The disaster relief efforts that may have the most money going into them may not go to the places that have taken the worst damage, that have had the most impact on human life.
That's right. For the most part, the number of deaths and the amount of money provided generally line up, but deaths aren't necessarily the most accurate number for need in the aftermath of a disaster. Like I mentioned, the number of affected people is probably a better measure to go off of, because you're looking people who need to have their homes replaced, who need to have food provided for them in the meantime. A lot of people may have lost their livelihood. Say you're a herder in a rural village and an earthquake or a flood comes and kills your livestock. That may completely undermine your ability to provide food and income for yourself. And so when you look at, take three recent very large disasters, for example, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, the 2010 earthquake that hit Haiti, and then the 2010 floods that hit Pakistan. And you'll see that Pakistan in the weeks after the disaster got just $16 per person, despite the fact that the floods affected more people than the Haitian earthquake and the tsunami combined. The per person totals for the Pakistan earthquake in 2005 were $388, and for the Indian Ocean tsunami were almost $1,250 per person.
So let's get into why some disasters get more attention than others. First of all, I guess earthquakes, tsunamis, they're sudden, they're flashy in some ways. We could see the immediate urgency. Something like a slower burn, like a flood or a famine, doesn't seem to generate the same response, you write.
That's right. And I think a lot of that is what you mentioned. It has to do with the fact that earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, things of that nature are those rapid onset kind of shock value events. But the one study that I was looking at that came out in 2007 actually said that in order for a famine like the one that we saw occur in the Horn of Africa in 2011 to get the same level of coverage in an American nightly newscast, you would need to have, as a single victim of an earthquake, you need to have 38,920 people die. And obviously, it can be difficult for a newscast to cover these types of slow-moving disasters, because the events are coming on over the course of several days or weeks. But at the same time, it's important to not allow the media, the daily demands of the media to affect the actual outcomes of disaster relief.
Talking to Tim Kovach about disaster relief, he says we need to make some changes in the way we provide relief for disasters around the world. Let's stay with the media, though, because you write that media coverage can drive the response from personal individual donors, from government donors, and that media response depends on the disaster and what else is in the news that day.
That's right. So, this study that I was looking at took data from 1968 to 2002 from an archive that Vanderbilt keeps of the U.S. nightly newscasts from the major broadcast networks, and what they found is that for every two minutes that the network spent on their top three stories, the likelihood that they'll actually end up covering any given disaster falls by 4%. And in addition, if the disaster occurs at the same time as the Olympics or the World Series, the likelihood of coverage is going to fall by 5 to 6%. And that can have a significant impact on the actual amount of, and the likelihood of aid being given and the amount of aid being given. And so what they did is they also looked at the amount of aid provided by the U.S. Agency for International Development's Office for Foreign Disaster Assistance, and that's the primary arm of the U.S. government for providing aid in the wake of disasters. And they found that if the nightly news broadcast covered a disaster, it would increase the likelihood that a disaster would get covered by 16%. But more than that, if it didn't cover the disaster would need to have six times more fatalities than one that occurred that did get coverage.
So far we've been looking at response after a disaster. You say that needs to change and it needs to be covered differently, addressed differently. But also you say we should rethink things and focus on disaster impact prevention, that a lot of what we think are natural disasters, acts of God, call them what you will, our behavior beforehand can affect the outcome a lot.
That's right. There's what I would consider to be a general misconception that disasters are, as you mentioned, acts of God. In reality, the literature says that a disaster is a combination of three things. It's a natural hazard, like a fault line or a tropical storm. It's our exposure to that disaster. So if we have, say, our house is built in a floodplain or lost along a coast or on top of a fault line, and then our vulnerability to that disaster. So say a homeless person who it doesn't have the ability to get shelter for the night is a lot more vulnerable to a tropical storm than a person who is able to be in a home that maybe have buried power lines or something like that, so they wouldn't even lose power. And so accordingly, it's really important to try to tackle those drivers of disaster risk before the disaster ever occurs. And the main way that we would go about this is a thing called disaster risk reduction. And there's a number of things that you can do to invest in disaster risk reduction. One example that's very popular is early warning systems. So in the U.S., if a tornado is going to hit like it does in the Midwest frequently, I live in Cleveland, so I'm not immune to that. You'll likely get a report. You'll likely get a notification from the National Weather Service on your smartphone, on your radio, on your television. But the same thing won't necessarily happen in a poor developing country. If you live in a rural area in Bangladesh and there's a tropical cyclone coming, you may not necessarily get the same level of reporting. And so it's important to invest in those types of early warning systems to give people the critical head start that they need to protect themselves and their property. Other examples are, say, investing in natural capital. So the one thing that I spoke about in the article was replanting mangrove forests. And these are a particular type of coastal wetland that are found in a lot of areas, but the vast majority of them have been cut down for various reasons since the mid part of the 20th century. But these mangroves are doing an outstanding job of buffering the impacts of storm surges and tsunamis. Their roots stick out in all different directions. They can essentially stop waves and really reduce the impact by up to 90%. So if we were to restore these mangrove forests, we could not only provide opportunities for people to harvest, say, non honey and building materials, but also protect them from disasters themselves.
So, Tim, in the aftermath of the major disaster, it's easy in some cases to persuade governments and individuals to donate. We see the immediate urgent need. How do you sell this sort of long-term thinking, a multi-year project to replant mangrove swamps or to build warning systems in a developing country?
Sure. And this is a difficult issue because a lot of people see disaster risk reduction as kind of separate from the development process. But the real important issue is to try to make the connections between existing development projects and disaster risk reduction, and also now to link it to climate change adaptation and mitigation. And so, there was a conference last month. It was the third World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction held in Sendai, Japan, which is actually kind of the epicenter of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan. And there were a lot of things that came out of that, but they actually set some concrete goals. And one thing was that Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, said that sustainability begins in Sendai. And what he meant by that was that later this year, coming up in September in New York, the UN is going to meet to develop a concrete list of what they're called sustainable development goals. And they're going to replace the Millennium Development Goals that were implemented in 2000 to try to reduce global poverty and improve access to water and sanitation and things of that nature. So sustainable development really needs to incorporate disaster risk reduction.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Kovach. He's an analyst and blogger. He researches and writes about disaster risk reduction. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. It's Food Friday here on Central Time. We're celebrating the beginning of the outdoor farmers market season in Wisconsin. The ginormous Dane County Market by the Capitol is set to start tomorrow, I believe. Other ones are kicking off over the next few weeks around the state. So we decided to ask Food Friday regular Lori Skelton to help us bridge the gap between winter and spring produce. She's with us to talk about how to bring together those leftover winter starches and the greens of spring. And we're taking your calls, too. What are you looking forward to cooking with in the spring? What spring dishes are you known for? What do you usually make with the first spoils of spring? And if you're going to be selling at a farmer's market in the next couple of weeks, what's coming up? What should we be planning on using? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lori Skelton is a Food Friday regular, one of WPR's in-house foodies. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be here.
All right. So what sparked this idea to explore what you're calling a spring transitional cooking?
This happens a lot whether you've got a CSA or you're just cleaning out the refrigerator, and you come across those last root vegetables that you've been hanging on to all winter, just haven't gotten around to eating. You know you need to finish the food. You don't want to waste it. But right now, what's available in terms of spring vegetables, we're just now coming on board. There's not a lot to choose from, and what's out there is going to be a little bit pricey. So the idea was find a way to combine the last of your winter starches with the first of your spring greens. And in some cases, even look beyond the farmer's market, looking to your actual own backyard. Mm-hmm. Eating some weeds can be quite fun in the spring.
I'm going to be honest with you, Lori. I sometimes avoid those early farmers markets and think, the good stuff's coming later. But you say we should be getting out there, getting some of these early spring things. There's enough to make it worth our while.
One of the things that we tend to forget with the attitude of, the good stuff's coming later, is what if somebody shows up with just a little bit of something that they're not sure they want to continue cultivating? Or is it worth the trouble for me to go foraging for a particular greenery or something that they find just in the forest? If you don't show up and support that farmer or that forager, it's not going to be around. So this is a wonderful way to take a chance on things. If it's just a little bit of green, you can try it as a side dish or incorporate it into a recipe you already have. You're not really losing out on anything, and you just might gain something.
Well, give us a quick rogues gallery before we start diving into the recipes you tried. What are some of the stars of the early spring green community?
Obviously, spinach is a great thing to start with. There are several farmers I know in the Madison market that do what they call frost-sweetened spinach, that the very first spinach of the year will always be fun to work with. But then there are things like ramps. Now, we always think of the bulb to chop up with our eggs or put in with our mushrooms, but ramp leaves are actually delightful to work with. Blanch them quickly in boiling water and chop them up, and they can be used just like a green. Obviously, they're going to have that pungent, wonderful, rampy flavor, but they can go in places where spinach might go. One of the things that I tried was finding different ways to make gnocchi, which are those little bite-sized Italian dumplings. They're usually made with potato. I found a lot of recipes online that would incorporate maybe two-thirds potato and one-third other root vegetable, like carrots or beets, but also things like spinach. And if you were to put ramp greens in with your potatoes for gnocchi, you almost wouldn't need sauce, maybe just a little bit of butter, and you're good to go.
Well, that's a great start for our fall starches, our winter starches, and some of those greens. Here's one. Now, all right, dandelions. Anybody with a lawn and a certain attitude doesn't like to see them.
Right. But the thing is, if you are trying to bring bees back into your area, you don't want to be using the Roundup on the dandelions. You really want to keep the dandelions out there because that's, in some cases, the first flowers that the bees are going to be able to get. So if you haven't used a weed killer on your lawn in a while, you can find the tenderest dandelion leaves, and they're wonderful to use. Throw a couple of handfuls into your salad, or you can do what I did. Again, treat them like spinach. Chop the stems, saute the stems, chop the leaves a little bit coarser, and saute those. Wilt them gently, and you can move them into a gratin.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I will say my problem with dandelion greens is I do that. I rinse them off and put them in salad. They get limp. They're kind of bitter. But in this gratin, we're calling it a sweet potato and dandelion greens au gratin, I would say, if
yes.
I looked at it. I thought it tasted great. I didn't get the bitterness that I associate with when I've tried to eat dandelion greens.
And that's because, one, I wasn't working with very old greens. I mean, they were certainly hefty, but they weren't so far past their pickable date that the bitterness really came through.
So that's key. Get the dandelions early.
That's certainly the main thing. You don't want to wait too long in the season to pull your dandelion greens. But the other thing I did was I paired them with sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you've got, even if it is a bitter green, the fact you're working with a starch that is so sweet was just amazing. There was your basic white sauce, which I added garlic and nutmeg to, and then it was layered with Gruyere cheese as well. So you've got a little bit of bitter, you've got a little bit of heft in that cheese, and then those wonderful sweet, sweet potatoes.
Talking to Lori Skelton about transitional cooking, taking the starches, the potatoes, the carrots, the things we've been eating all winter while waiting for the new produce, and getting those first spring bits of produce, merging them together, make some interesting recipes. Give us the basics on that au gratin. What are the steps toward making that?
Well, fortunately, this is the one that we have the recipe on the Central Time website and the Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And you have raw sweet potatoes. You slice them thinly, but you don't have to worry about pre-cooking those ahead of time. Once you've wilted down your greens, and I will admit I wilted them down with a little bit of wine rather than straight water, but once you've got the greens wilted down, it's just a matter of a layer of the sweet potatoes in a buttered 9x13 baking dish, a little bit of the white sauce, a little bit of the greens, cheese on top, one more layer, extra cheese on top, a little bit more salt and pepper, throw it in the oven for 45 minutes until the top is bubbly golden brown, and This was gone in less than an hour.
This
Everybody loved it.
I loved it. This was a really good one. And again, it's on the Central Time Facebook page. That's the sweet potato and dandelion greens au gratin.
Although I really think it needs a shorter name. Somebody suggested we'd be gone, but I don't think we can say that.
Yeah, it doesn't sound appetizing.
So if anybody can come up with a shorter name for sweet potato and dandelion greens au gratin, let us know.
All right. Well, we had a soup this time. You had some, turnips and parsnips. What was the spring element in this one?
Watercress.
Watercress. That was it.
Now, here I was working from a cookbook called Secrets of Longevity from Dr. Mao Sheng. And his idea was, again, take your old, tired winter greens and or winter starches and throw them with a vibrant spring green. I will say this. I like the concept, but what we came up with I still think needed a bit more flavor. This was simply simmer everything together for 40 minutes and then serve immediately. No salt, no pepper, no fat. None of the vegetables were sautéed in butter or oil before we started cooking them. And the general comment was, it's a nice idea, but by simmering the watercress that long, we've lost the zing of that green. My suggestion would be if you're going to be putting together a soup with a watercress, gently caramelize your vegetables, then simmer them in your vegetable stock, then add the watercress for just the last 5 minutes so it gets cooked, but it doesn't get cooked to bits, and then throw it in the blender. I really think this would have worked better as a puree rather than a broth. Maybe some people are thinking, well, it's got to be purist. I want just the broth and the vegetables, nothing else between me and the essence of the meal. I wouldn't have minded it being just a little creamier. Maybe adding a little bit of parsley oil at the end would have helped as well.
So if we encounter some watercress, maybe at a farmer's market in the next couple of weeks, it sounds like our lesson here is don't overcook it. Just give a little something. Otherwise, you're going to lose the distinctive flavor.
Obviously, watercress is lovely fresh. But if you, again, want to extend it and put it into a dish, wait until the last 5 minutes.
We're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about how to combine the last of winter's produce with the first of the spring greens as farmers market season kicks off one market at a time around the state. And we want to hear from you. What is your favorite spring produce? Are you holding out for a local asparagus maybe? What are the things you look forward to as the farmers markets start to open up? If you're on the other side of things, if you're selling at a farmer's market or you have a farm, a big garden, a CSA, what's coming up? What are you looking forward to cooking with? Some recipe advice, or maybe you have a question. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Check out Lori's recipe while you're there. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We have Lori Skelton with us. She has advice on taking the last of the winter stuff, the potatoes, the turnips, the parsnips, the carrots, and combining it with the first of the New Year's produce, dandelion greens, watercress, early spinach, you name it. And you can join the conversation. Are you cooking along these lines? Are you looking forward to farmers markets? What are you looking forward to getting? Do you have some ideas for great spring cooking? Do you forage in your own backyard for maybe dandelion greens or other usable foods? And if you are a farmer yourself, what is coming up? What's looking good? What are people going to go nuts for when you hit the farmer's market this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Lori, you told us how to make peace with one enemy, dandelions, and use those greens and that sweet potato and dandelion greens au gratin. Garlic mustard.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a recipe for that. We had it this week.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I didn't know. I mean, it's got garlic and mustard both in the name. I didn't know we could actually eat this stuff.
This is a noxious weed. This is an invasive thing that just takes over. And everyone I know who has a garden or who even has a woods they're trying to maintain and keep from getting overrun with invasive will be out getting rid of the garlic mustard. And you have to dig it up. You have to get rid. This stuff is just so noxious. And the thing is, it keeps coming back every year, no matter how careful you are. So years ago, somebody told me, you know, you can make pesto out of garlic mustard. I thought they were crazy at the time. I have since discovered garlic mustard pesto is amazing. Basically, you're talking a packed cup of roughly chopped garlic mustard leaves, oh, maybe half a cup of Parmesan cheese, and depending on how you're going to use it, 1 to 2 tablespoons of olive oil. That's your basic recipe. If you're going to add it to pasta, one thing garlic mustard really does well with garlic mustard pesto in a pasta salad, it's great cold. It's nice over hot pasta, but there's something about having that mustard and garlic flavor on cold pasta salads that are just, it's just out of this world. What I did this week was I made a ricotta tart base, just puff pastry with some ricotta cheese and cream on top of that. It's in this month's Bon Appetit magazine as the basis for a roasted root vegetable tart. I gently browned some cipollini onions, the sweeter onions, scattered them across the tart, baked the tart, and then to garnish it, I just loaded that thing with garlic mustard pesto. It's amazing. And you're basically, you're eating your enemy. You are gaining your enemy's strength by really taking over.
It was delicious. Maybe we'll get into the dough, the phyllo dough in a bit. Let's go to a caller, though, at 800-642-1234. We've got Becky on the line with us in Milwaukee. Becky, hi there.
Hi. I'm calling. One of my favorite things to make in spring from the farmer's market is a garlic scape pesto. Olive oil, Parmesan, and almonds.
Using almonds for the pesto. And what do you end up serving? Just put it on pasta, Becky, or do you use in other recipes then?
I will usually put it over like lean chicken breasts or tilapia and bake it until it's kind of almost like a crusted topping.
That
sounds fantastic. Becky, thank you so much for that. Garlic scapes, what's particular? What's unique about those, Lori?
Well, if you planted garlic last fall, and garlic is weird. You have to plant it in the fall. It has to sit over winter, and it's one of the first things to come up in the spring. And while you may have set out your neat rows of garlic over the fall, things do shift over the winter. You do have to thin out your garlic bed in the spring. So this is just the very young garlic. Usually it's what you've thinned out, or if you planted enough, you just go ahead and rip out part of the patch. It's just very young garlic. It certainly tastes like garlic, but it does have that fresher, greener flavor. And you can use the whole thing. It's not just the bulb. It's the whole, the stem, the leaf. And like ramp leaves, you can blanch them or put them in a pesto like you just heard. Almonds are a great idea. Pine nuts may be a little what we're used to with a basil pesto, but pine nuts can sometimes overwhelm those delicate greens. Almonds are a great choice.
Thank you so much for saying that you can use the whole part of
Absolutely.
The garlic scape, because I've sat there holding them like, do I do this or this? And I usually do the bulb part. You can use the whole thing.
Just throw it with some olive oil and Parmesan in the blender, then take it out, add your nuts to it. Yeah, easy. You just make certain you've got the dirt off.
Becky, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Food Friday, talking to Lori Skelton, making the most of our early spring greens and other stuff, and mixing it with what we have left of sweet potatoes, other starches, and things like that. You had some. I had a spinach idea. I think you wanted to talk about, Lori.
Spinach is a lovely thing in the spring all on its own. But if you want to combine spinach with your older root vegetables, a really nice way to do it is to gently steam the vegetables, leave them in fairly nice-sized chunks, and then use that with your spinach for a wilted spinach salad. Most people think wilted spinach salad with hard-cooked eggs and red onion and hot bacon dressing. So I was out to find out some variant of a hot dressing that would be vegetarian or vegan that you could use in combination with other vegetables. And what seems to come up a lot on the internet and I think would make a really good combination would be 2 tablespoons of light-tasting canola oil combined with 2 teaspoons of sesame oil. Gently heat that in a saucepan, then add a little Dijon mustard, some rice vinegar, maybe some honey, or maybe some miso. You're going to get, with the miso, some of the flavor of soy sauce, but more of a rounded flavor, more of a mouth-filling flavor that would pair so beautifully with veggies.
So I can see the sesame oil and maybe that miso. That covers what you're missing if you think of the bacon. That covers that range of flavors, huh?
You're getting umami again.
Umami.
I'm starting to think there should be a Lori's Food Friday drinking game. Take a big drink of whatever every time I say umami.
Oh, that's so. Other things you're looking forward to, Lori, that things that aren't maybe up yet, maybe won't be at the farmers markets that start this weekend. But what is next on the list?
Next on the list will be very specific, the very wonderful morel mushrooms, which will be coming up at some point, maybe even in your back garden. You never know. And that will be added to what's already coming up in my garden, the thing that I talked about a year ago, sorrel, those lemony tart, one of the first greens to come up. There is a wonderful recipe in Deborah Madison's Greens Cookbook from the Greens Restaurant in San Francisco, where you make a mushroom timbal, where a lot of mushrooms are blended up with a little bit of custard and baked in a ramekin and then unmolded, and you put this sorrel sauce with a little bit of creme fraiche and a lot of lovely lemony leaves on top of those morel mushrooms, and that's just out of this world. But then again, with morels, all you really need to do is just fry them in butter.
I was going to say, I've made morel mushrooms myself a couple of times. The ingredient list was butter, morels, and pepper. That's all I did.
That's really all they needed. So that is the thing I'm waiting for.
Well, I want to get into a couple brief technique tips. Wilting spinach. I use spinach. It's either raw or I'm like, you know, really cooking it down.
Okay.
How do we wilt it?
When you are wilting your spinach, do you separate leaves from stems? Do you cook the stems?
Sometimes. I'm not wilting it. I'm like, you know, I'm cooking it on a cast iron skillet. Boom. Your wilting sounds like it's just a quick little thing.
I guess it depends on how wilted you like your spinach. For me,
seared. I'm thinking I sear the spinach.
I'm not a fan of that much caramelization on spinach, at least not at this time of the year. I could see doing that later in the season. Say, if you've got spinach in your garden and it's gotten a little bit old, even if it's bolted, caramelizing it that way, searing it that way would be a way to bring back some flavor.
Okay. So the tougher stuff I want to do that way.
I think so. That's my palate. Certainly, spinach, you can play a lot with it. A lot depends also whether or not you are doing your spinach on the stovetop and then immediately serving it, or are you wilting it slightly on the stovetop so that you can then put it in the oven and, say, bake it under baked eggs or something like that?
Yeah, searing I'd be serving right away. Wilting is that thing if it's a step along the way.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Well, Lori, thank you as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Lori Skelton, Food Friday regular, one of WPR's in-house foodies. She was with us to talk about how to bring together our winter produce, the leftover stuff, our spring produce in our kitchens. Springtime's upon us. Sunshine, warmth, green, allergies. Why not write a poem? That's my contribution to International Haiku Day. Haiku Day was started by a group called the Haiku Foundation to draw attention to the millennium-old Japanese poetry form and especially to encourage English language haiku, hopefully better than mine. Old school haiku is supposed to have 17 syllables in groups of 5, 7, and 5, a seasonal reference now, and a cutting word, something that makes a connection or contrast between two ideas. There have been lots of different takes, I guess, on the form over the centuries. Inviting you now, try your hand, celebrate the day, write a haiku, and then share it over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I tried it, by the way, today. There are enough characters on Twitter to fit a haiku. And that's part of what I love about haiku. If you like poetry, it's easy to get a lot of haiku. You can get it in bulk. If you don't like poetry, haiku, it's over quickly. You don't have to suffer through it too long. Well, again, share your own haiku at the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up next, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we cover the biggest headlines from around the state this week, including a recent poll showing public reaction to the governor's budget. It's our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is back with me on Monday. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.